And I'm sure you've heard those, especially those of you who, you know, have loved ones in the Society of St. Pius V. And of course, not everybody who goes to the SSPV, you know, to their chapels is also, you know, card-carrying, hardcore Pius V, anti-took and all that. We know that, but you may have heard these objections before. Objection number one, the took consecrations have not been proved according to the norms of church law. That's Bishop Kelly right there, okay? And the response, quite simply, is wrong. It's false, okay? And why is it false? Because canon law recognizes as needing no further proof that which is notorious in fact, and the took consecrations are notorious in fact. End of story. That's really all there is to it, okay? They therefore meet the requirements of church law to allow and require us to accept them. Okay, that's how we answer that objection. And again, you can find all the detail, all the nitty-gritty, the footnotes and quotes and all of that in my study, if you're interested. And by the way, the study is available online. You can download it for free on the internet, or you can also purchase a copy from the bookstore here from the CMRI. Objection number two. There were no witnesses present at the took consecrations who can vouch that Bishop Took used the correct matter and form in conferring the sacrament. Right? That is the big SSPV objection. Now, you know what? That's true, but irrelevant. It's true. It's irrelevant because canon law puts the burden of ensuring that the proper use of the sacramental rite on the consecrator and no one else. Canon 1002. Unfortunately, I didn't bring a copy of the Code of Canon Law with me, but it says right there that it is the duty of the minister, of the one who administers the sacrament. He must make sure that it's done correctly, obviously, right? I mean, who else would? No one else has the obligation to ensure that the consecrator did it right. The church requires us to presume that the sacrament was conferred validly, absent any evidence to the contrary, once we know the ceremony has taken place. Right? That's what we went over earlier. If there is no such evidence, we are not permitted to doubt validity. Okay, that is the church's position. And as far as what Bishop Kelly says about witnesses, it all, I think, originates in a complete misunderstanding of what witnesses are for. Again, it would be extremely helpful for you, if you're interested in this topic, to get that book, Proof of the Reception of the Sacraments by Father Sullivan, published in 1944. You will never read that book and come away thinking Bishop Kelly is right. You will not. And I'm guessing he didn't read it. Whenever the church talks about witnesses, there's some exceptions as far as private baptism, and we'll get into that in a minute. Whenever the church talks about witnesses, she means witnesses to the ceremony, not witnesses to, you know, did the bishop use the right holy oils and did he impose hands? Not that, but, you know, witnesses to, yes, I was there. I was there at the ceremony. Okay? That's what the church means when she talks about witnesses. And Bishop Kelly completely twists and misunderstands that in his book. Then objection number three. This is one of my favorites. An 1853 decree from the Sacred Congregation of Rites requires, in the absence of co-consecrating bishops, assistant priests at an Episcopal consecration to ensure that things are done correctly. The decree, ladies and gentlemen, Reverend clergy, actually says no such thing. I actually retrieved it from the internet. It was online. The decree merely states, and I could quote it to you. It's in my study. I just don't have it handy right now. But if you'd like me to look it up in the question and answer session, I'd be happy to. The decree says no such thing. It merely states that the assistant priests, when replacing the co-consecrating bishops, ought to observe the rubrics of the Roman Pontifical in the same way as the co-consecrating bishops. That's all that's said in that decree. It was actually, ironically, it was a bishop from Vietnam asking the Sacred Congregation of Rites in 1853, submitted a request to the Sacred Congregation and asked, hey, you know, when in a case of an Episcopal consecration where there are no co-consecrators, where there's only one bishop consecrating instead of three, and we have assistant priests there, what are they supposed to do? I mean, they're not bishops, right? And the Holy See simply replied, just have them follow, you know, what it says in the Roman Pontifical. Just do that. And Bishop Kelly completely misconstrued that, and I think because he probably didn't check the actual reference, he just looked at Father Clancy's book, which, of course, I can't think of it right now. I can't think of the title, which makes reference to that decree. Yeah, so Bishop Kelly kind of twists that into, oh no, the assistant priests must check on the consecrator and ensure that he doesn't accidentally invalidate the sacrament. Okay, it's absurd. As a matter of fact, if we go back to Canon 1002, where church law says that the minister of the sacrament has the obligation that the sacrament is conferred validly, well, guess what? The assistant priests aren't ministers of the sacrament of holy orders, okay? So there is no duty on them to make sure that the sacrament is conferred validly. Now, certainly they probably all would do that, but they're not required to. And Bishop Kelly cannot make that into a requirement. It's as simple as that. So much for objection three. I just got a few more. Objection four. Just as the church requires witnesses at a private baptism who can testify to the correct use of matter and form, so does the church require witnesses for clandestine episcopal consecrations. This is, again, another objection taken from Bishop Kelly's book, The Sacred and the Profane. It completely false, complete nonsense, okay? And this has a rather lengthy response. I'm just going to read it to you, and then I'll elaborate a little bit on it. The response is, this is false. There is no analogy to a private baptism. A private baptism is not a baptism at which there are almost no people present, but one that is conferred in an emergency situation with only the essential rites, only matter and form, right? It is often performed by a layman, right, in a case of emergency. And Father Casimir was alluding to that a few days ago in his talk on the sacraments. Private baptism is distinguished from solemn baptism, at which the pastor uses the full liturgical ceremony in the church. Now, here's the crucial point. There is no such distinction to be found with episcopal consecrations. Okay, there's no such thing as a private episcopal consecration, you know, in case of emergency, quick, you know, I need to make you a bishop here. You know, impose hands, rattle off the 16 words, got a bishop, right? No. There's only one way to consecrate a bishop in the Roman Rite, and that is by means of the whole full liturgical ceremony in the Roman Pontifical. But quickly to get back to that private baptism thing, one or two validity witnesses are required, or at least highly desired, for a private baptism, if the person baptizing is a layman and not properly instructed in how to baptize. This cannot be made analogous to episcopal consecrations at which only two laymen are present, like in the 1981 two consecrations. It was only Dr. Hiller and Dr. Heller there. But anyway, there is no analogy to a private baptism because these episcopal consecrations with only a few people there are not private consecrations in the sense of a private baptism. Bishop Took was the ordinary minister of the consecrations. He was a bishop, and a bishop is the ordinary minister of the sacrament of holy orders. And he was certainly properly trained in how to confer them. In 1981, Bishop Took had been a bishop for 43 years. He knew how to consecrate bishops. Okay? Generally speaking, and I think I've already touched on this, whenever the church speaks of witnesses to a sacrament, she is referring to witnesses to the ceremony, not specifically to the validity of the sacrament. And one of Bishop Kelly's fundamental mistakes in his book is he keeps confusing witnesses to the ceremony with witnesses to the validity. He keeps confusing proving that a sacramental ceremony take place and proving that the sacrament was valid. And that is one of the biggest mistakes, and it is the reason why he just concludes a lot of things wrong. The church herself acknowledges that all the legal formalities for the conferral of a sacrament only serve to prove that the sacrament was conferred, not that it was valid. Because such validity, again, is presumed absent evidence to the contrary. So, this was really great when I did my research. It was great to find a quote. I forgot exactly who said it, but it's in my study. It was a priest, and he says, even in ordinary times, you know, if everything is done properly and you go to the diocese and you want to see if somebody was baptized or ordained or whatever, all that proves is that he underwent the ceremony. Doesn't prove it was valid, because remember, that's presumed, right? You can't prove it. You can only prove that all the elements are present that allow us to presume the sacrament valid. So even if we had, you know, papal endorsement and all these things regarding any sacrament, still doesn't prove it was valid. Just proves it occurred, and the validity is presumed. And objection number five. The two consecrations must be considered doubtful because Bishop Took's mental state was questionable because of his bizarre and inconsistent behavior. For example, consecrating unworthy candidates, flip-flopping on sedevacantism, and so forth. Now, I won't deny that there is, objectively speaking, there was some worrisome behavior with Bishop Took, right, considering whom he consecrated. But none of this is sufficient evidence that Bishop Took's mental state was so compromised that he was unable to meet the minimal requirements necessary for the valid conferral of a sacrament, because the bar for sacramental validity is fairly low as far as the minister's mental state goes. In order for the church to presume a sacrament valid, the right matter and form must be properly applied by the minister with the intention of doing what the church does, right? So therefore, all that is required of the minister in terms of the mental state is that he be so mentally competent as to be able to form that intention. Now, the minimum necessary intention is called in sacramental theology a virtual intention. Okay, and you have this virtual intention when you act with deliberation, even though you may be distracted, even voluntarily. Okay, our intellect, in other words, must be minimally connected to the action we are performing. And a very great common sense example that most of us can probably relate to is speaking on the phone while driving a car. You ever been wrapped up in a phone conversation, and later on you wonder, oh my goodness, how did I get to my destination? I don't even remember driving. No, I've had that before. All this time I intended to be driving, let me assure you. I did. It was an act that proceeded from my intellect and my will. I knew I was driving. I wasn't paying attention to it much, but I knew I was driving, and I meant to be driving. That is the virtual intention. Okay? The bar is very low, you can see. You just need to have this sort of intention for having this, you know, the sufficient intention to confect the sacrament. Because this is what suffices for the so-called human act. And I explained that in greater detail in my study. And so therefore, it suffices for the sacramental intention. The sacramental act, the administration of the sacrament, basically just has to be an act that proceeds from knowledge and free will. Okay? So, frankly, there is no evidence that during the consecration ceremonies, Bishop Took was not acting from knowledge and free will. You'd have to, if you say, oh, well, I'm not sure, you know, he had the sufficient intention, I'm not sure that his sacramental administration really proceeded from knowledge and free will, well, you would have to imagine then that Bishop Took didn't realize he was consecrating bishops. Okay? that's simply absurd. Goodness, we have one more objection. I didn't. Okay. Objection number 6. Oh yeah, this is a good one. Even if the Took lineage is valid, we can have nothing to do with any of the clerics ordained or consecrated in the Took line because it is sordid. You've heard that one, haven't you? Yeah? No? Where do you live? I'm in Cincinnati. I'm sorry. Okay, well, what's the problem with this objection? Well, first of all, the objection is vague. It's not precise enough. Just what in the world does sordid mean? Right? It's not a technical term used in sacred theology. And you can't, but you know, it's very popularly appealing, you know. It works well with a lot of people, you know. You go to the pulpit and you say, the Took line is sordid. And everybody goes, oh, you know. No, those filthy Took bishops. Well, the term does not exist in sacramental theology or in sacred theology. So I sat down as I wrote my study and I asked myself, okay, what could they possibly mean? Well, I came up with 3 answers what they could possibly mean. Number 1 would be that they mean we cannot approach the Took line except in danger of death because, number 1, the sacraments in this lineage are in themselves defiled. That's one possible meaning of sordid that I could think of. Now, to say such a thing, and this is not, let me emphasize this, as far as I know, this is not what the Society of St. Pius V is saying. That would be horrendous. This is blasphemy, okay? The sacraments are in themselves holy because they were instituted by God as a means of sanctification, okay? In fact, if this were not the case, we could not approach the Took line even in danger of death, all right? And even, you know, if we had a pope again, even he couldn't regularize the Took. If the sacraments were defiled, there's nothing the pope could do either. Okay, so this is just one meaning, possible meaning of sordid, and hopefully nobody means that. Okay, so this is out of the question. Now, another meaning of sordid is that we cannot approach the Took line because it would be sinful to do so because it would violate the moral law. It would be a sin, okay? Well, the only way it could violate the moral law is if there were a church law forbidding it because the reception of the sacraments and the administration of the sacraments is governed by church law, not the moral law, okay? So if we want to say it's sinful, all right, fair enough. But then they must point to a church law that would forbid us from approaching the Took line for the sacraments. And that is really the third possible meaning of sordid, is that we cannot approach the Took line because the church forbids us from doing so in her law, to which I say, okay, what's the law? Which law are we talking about? Okay, so my response to that one is the assertion lacks clear evidence. The objector would have to demonstrate this from canon law, and I have not seen the Societies in Pius V do that, so until they do, I can't respond to it. You hear insinuations maybe made or whatever, but what I would like to see is I want to tell them, put pen to paper and write down, here's this law, here's that law, here's how the two consecrations fulfill, these conditions, therefore you cannot approach the tuk line. That's what I want to see, because I think that's the only fair way to do this, okay? And I want to see it in print with footnotes, and I want to be able to check out the evidence. So until they do that, I think there's simply nothing to respond to. So I would like to appeal to the Society of St. Pius V. Please acknowledge the facts, okay? I'm sure they weren't happy when they all received a copy of my study in January of this year, but I would like to ask them to please respond to these arguments, okay? And I would like them to respond in public and in writing. It's very important. Yes, it must be in writing, because it's so easy to just say something from the pulpit and, nobody can object, nobody can, really do anything about it. I want them to put it in writing, because then they have to prove what they say and they have to put all their cards on the table. And so the ball is now in their court. And I want to ask them, even if you disagree with everything I just said, am I really being unreasonable? Love my study or hate it, it's not unreasonable. Besides, if these two consecrations are really as dangerous as they claim, why not take the time to respond to the evidence presented? Right? Why not? We all want to go to heaven here. Why won't they do it? And this probably comes as no surprise to you, but to this date, no answer has been received. Not even an acknowledgement. I don't even necessarily expect an answer only a few months, because I know it's a huge document and it's a lot to read and all that, but it would have been nice to get somebody saying, okay, hey, we got it, we'll read it, or we've read it, we'll respond later, or whatever, we'll consider it, because this is all very serious business. It's not a game, and I really don't know how much more reasonable and fairly I can do it. I think that what I've presented is reasonable, and whether they agree with it or not, I don't think anybody can say that it's not worth a response. Okay, I think we at least deserve that much. And if you don't see yourself reading 100 pages anytime soon, you can go to the website, tookbishops.com. There's also a 5-page summary posted of the study, which is also part of the study. Just, when you get a very condensed presentation, just like this presentation here, very abridged, very simplified. Likewise, the summary is just a summary of points. It really doesn't... It's not a substitute for reading the whole study, but it will. I thought it was good to include that in there, because when people read so much text and so much technical terminology, after 65 pages, they're maybe scratching their heads and said, "Okay, what were we saying again?" And so I wanted to include a summary. And I'm going to close, but before we go to questions and answers, I wanted to close with a quote from Pope Pius XI. And that quote will not need any commentary. In his encyclical Divini Redemptoris in 1937, His Holiness wrote, "To all our children, we make another and more urgent appeal for union. Many times our paternal heart has been saddened by the divergencies, often idle in their causes, always tragic in their consequences, which array in opposing camps the sons of the same mother church. Thus it is that the radicals, who are not so very numerous, profiting by this discord, are able to make it more acute and end by pitting Catholics one against the other. Those who make a practice of spreading dissension among Catholics assume a terrible responsibility before God and the Church. Thank you.